Hello, and welcome to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and right here in the studio, Ben Golver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. We've been here all week. We're getting on each other's nerves. I can kind of feel it. I felt bad this morning. I woke up. I just didn't feel good about it. We had planned this podcast, and I think it was a really good idea. I think it's going to be cathartic because it's going to bring us back together on a positive note to close this week. What do you say?
This is our third pod of the week. We're recording this on a Friday. It's going to run next week. Yesterday's top 100 pod, by the final 45 minutes, I was getting pretty frustrated with you.
At one point, I told you you could swear at me, but you couldn't swear at Rob. I think that was the highlight of the entire show ever.
Yeah. You know, so the top 100 pod was about 30 minutes too long. It was incredibly disorganized, and it got progressively heated. So thank you to anyone who stuck with us throughout that journey, and especially thank you to Rob Mahoney, who was terrific at keeping the peace.
Let me ask you this, though. Every podcast producer and executive and like person who knows the space, they always say embrace debate, right? Like, they're basically saying our best practices should be just you and me tearing each other down for an hour and a half. That's the best podcast. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think in general, yes, we're good at tearing each other down, and it's fun, and we can both take it. I think yesterday I was ready to strangle you because we kept having the same argument over and over and over again. But again, Rob Mahoney is the nicest person in the world and also really smart.
So he lost it a little bit, which was great. I mean, we got to waiters and he really got passionate back at you. So I loved it. The reason why I asked you that question, though, just like philosophically, is because we had another talk with legendary Lou Pellegrino, our podcast editor. And he basically told us like nostalgia really plays. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be screaming. You can just take trips down memory lane. And people dig that too. And I was like, yeah, we don't do that very often, do we?
Well, he was also like, you guys don't really have that much to talk about. There's not that much NBA news going on. So we're going to try something today. But before we do, I want to say, number one, reviews help. So we're at like 300 reviews right now.
See, I've seen some podcasts like 10,000. And we know you guys are out there sitting around not reviewing. So do it.
My goal is to get to 500 reviews by Christmas. I think we can do it.
My goal is 750.
Okay. Yeah, so Ben's dreaming big over here. And the other thing is we're going to follow up on the Top 100 pod next Friday. Or this Friday. And hit us up with emails at openfloormail@gmail.com. We're not going to address any top 100 specifics on this pod because I think we're trying to keep the peace today.
I think that's a good idea. But and there's going to be another way. We know because there's going to be points that I didn't make, points that maybe people felt you could make better. I mean, there's going to be things we just didn't touch on, questions about guys who we didn't have a chance to discuss. And so we can pull all those back together, right?
The most interesting part of the discussion was like the final 3 minutes when we both sort of realized the top 15 was like a little too safe. And I think it'll be really interesting to see how it changes because right now you guys were like dead on. But I don't know. Maybe Anthony Davis is going to be top five by mid-year.
No, I like that you think the most interesting part of that podcast was when I had a mental breakdown over ranking KD at 2 and thinking at the very last moment after a month of work that maybe he should have been number 1. That's telling that you would find that the most interesting.
All right, let's get into what we have planned today. I want to talk about our 10 favorite games that we've ever been to. You picked 5, I've picked 5. And so I'll let you lead off here.
So a couple of conditions up front. I don't want anyone to hold these against me forever because it's possible I missed something and it's possible that my memory is shot from 7 or 8 straight years worth of Twitter. So mine's a little bit backloaded, but I did try to have a mix of different games. I'm going to start with one for the 503 for the Blazers fans out there. Can you guess which game I'm going to?
Is it a Brandon Roy game winner?
Not a Brandon Roy game winner.
Okay.
Playoffs.
I don't know, one of those Lakers-Blazers games?
No, it's actually more recent. It's the Damian Lillard shot. And it might be a little cliche, but I want to just explain and paint when he hit that shot against the Rockets because that was such a big deal for the franchise and for the fan base. And it took a while, right? So I started covering the Blazers in 07, 08, like right after the Odin lottery ping pong ball falls their way. And much like the Sixers right now, it was like immediate. These guys are going to be contenders, right?
Right.
And it just did not happen. And the years got so much darker than I think people realize because Portland stuck away in a small market. If it had been in New York or Philly or any of these other, Chicago, any of these other big situations that got as dark as it did injury-wise with not only Brandon Roy, but like LaMarcus Aldridge is having his heart checked out and Greg Oden is basically never on the court. That was such a tough sled.
Yeah, I mean,
for all those
big
fans.
Picture, it's shocking that Blazers fans still find a way to care and get fired up about this team after all the bad luck they've had over the last 30 years.
And what I would say is, from the inside, it's not shocking at all because, like, these are the kinds of people who are like, torture me, bring it on. Like, let's do it.
Torture me.
Like, waterboard me, electrocute me, I'm ready. You know,
yeah.
Like, that is the level of devotion to the team, right? And so going into that series, people didn't know what to expect. Lillard's kind of sort of still an unknown quantity. Everyone's got these questions about LaMarcus. He has these huge breakout games early in the series, 40-point games.
He looked unstoppable for about like the first three games of that series.
But for Blazers fans, it's kind of like fool's gold, right? It's like, wait a minute. He just had his two best games back-to-back. Like, what do we do, right? And you get into this situation where they had just been waiting and waiting and waiting for it. And all the hype had been the Houston's way. I mean, guys like Harden and Howard, I mean, much bigger stars.
Was that a 4-5 matchup?
That's a good question. That sounds right.
Yeah.
But the series was starting to slip. You know, if they lose this game at home, they have to go back on the road to end the series.
Mm-hmm.
That could be one of these things where they're one of these teams that, you know, blows a lead and it kind of stains them. And they remember, key feature here. Throughout that Odin, Roy, LaMarcus era, they never won a playoff series. They never even made it to a game seven, right? So this is a 14-year period the fans had been waiting for their first playoff series victory. Lillard hits the shot less than a second. I mean, it's a perfect YouTube clip. I mean, all the courtside views that people were taking.
It was incredible.
But what I remember about it, why it's one of my favorites, is because occasionally, this is going to sound psycho, but occasionally I can see the future. Like,
yeah.
I just have that ability. I don't know if you know this or not, but I do. And sometimes I can't. Like, I almost got hit by a car once. Like, that would have been a great time for that skill to come through. Like, when I was just walking across the street during the Orlando All-Star Weekend. I got saved by Sergio, my old podcast editor. But I saw the future.
Yeah.
As soon as the basket goes in on the other end, I said, there's too much time left. They
mm-hmm.
they just gave these guys a shot that they shouldn't have. Somehow the Blazers are going to figure it out. And this is a franchise that had not figured it out. I mean, the whole quote-unquote jailblazer era, all the injury stuff, everything had broken wrong. And for whatever reason, I saw the future and was like, this is going to be the moment. So I set up my phone on the media row.
Yeah. Did you take one of the gorilla videos
I
of
did.
The Lillard game winner?
I would argue that mine hit YouTube first. I'm not saying that I have the best thing, but like literally I was in the zone. I was in a trance.
That was part of the experience for me. I was in LA at that point, and after Lillard hit that shot, I spent probably the next 7 to 10 days going through YouTube and watching like courtside video of the game winner.
No, some of the courtside shots are unbelievable. So our media seats during the playoffs aren't great in Portland.
Yeah.
But it did have a nice wide angle perspective, right? So I just set my camera up, took it, and then what unfolded was unlike almost anything I've seen in an NBA arena, because we know what jubilation and like ecstasy looks like, right?
Yeah.
This was like something completely past that. I mean, there's people running back and forth like chickens with their heads cut off, just in circles. Like they could have lost their wallets. They wouldn't have cared. They're screaming, hugging strangers. People were crying.
Yeah.
And there was media members. I'm not going to call anybody out, but there was media members doing the same thing. Like people were losing their absolute minds.
Given what I know about Blazers media, that's not terribly surprising.
Yeah, okay. But you get what I'm saying.
No, it's not going to happen. I don't blame anyone.
You look at 30 NBA markets. We could probably say 5 or 6 where something like that could happen.
Yeah.
Trigger that kind of an emotional response. And what the crazy part in hindsight is, it was for a first round series victory.
Yeah, man.
You know, like this was like 77, because you know the shadow of that 1977 title hangs over the whole city. I mean, everyone's always talking about Bill Walton and the parade. The Blazers made the playoffs one year. They had a parade just for making the playoffs because it had been so long since they had been able to have anything worthy of a parade. You've got bars called Spirit of 77. I mean, guys like Lucas. I mean, that whole team is just revered on a completely different level. And you could say even today's stars are kind of overshadowed by those guys to a certain degree. And this was like the one moment where it was like totally pure and they broke through and they did it.
Yeah.
And for people who, like, season ticket holders who've been waiting 14 years since the last time they went to the second round of the playoffs, that was pretty cool.
That was awesome. I will add only two things. First of all, I think we forget how awful James Harden was in most of that series.
Recurring thing.
He's kind of in Teflon as far as playoff failures. Somehow we don't bring these up.
I don't know about that. I think we do remember it when we think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it does come to mind, right?
Yeah, because but that was, I mean, like, they came into that series with all kinds of advantages. And Dwight actually did a decent job.
Yeah.
They couldn't guard LaMarcus for the first half of the series. But Harden just, like, was nowhere to be found. And I don't remember whether we wound up blaming the Lillard open three on Parsons or Harden. I think that's still, like, a point of contention.
Yeah.
But I will just add that I saw the future as well.
Really?
Because
I didn't know you had this ability.
I was working at Grantland at the time, and that Friday, I think the game was on a Friday night.
Okay.
And that Friday, I published, like, it was way too long, like a power rankings of players in the playoffs. And I had Dame at number one. And I had...
You would.
My description was, like, I was talking to my roommate, and I was living with Mike Levin at the time. And we were talking about how, like, the clutch gene isn't real. We all know it's not real. But, like, Damian Lillard makes you wonder. And that was before he went out and hit that fucking three to win it. And it was just wild. It was like, it was almost eerie to have that happen, like, the night that was published.
Yeah, and the way he shot it, too, and just taking the mic and everything.
Yeah,
you know,
it was so cool. It was, that's why I spent the next week watching videos of it.
It was great. And it was also redemption for B-Roy never quite having it. You know, like, I think for fans who totally bought into B-Roy, I think...
B-Roy had it. He just had bad knees.
No, but he never had that playoff series. He never had that crowning achievement moment where, like, we're winning a series. He had a great comeback against the Mavericks, right? But it winds up going for nothing because,
yeah,
you know, he never had the breakthrough. Like, B-Roy, I mean, Dame's kind of living this,
like, B-Roy hit some,
like,
big shots.
Oh, he had unbelievable 50 plus point games.
Yeah.
And he was great. I think in terms
why
of,
do you hate Brandon Roy?
Yeah, I know. It's really weird how you're doing this. You're really ruining the nostalgia of the moment. I mean, if I had to say, like, who are my favorite Blazers ever,
yeah,
personally, B-Roy is above Damian. It's not even close,
yeah,
right? And I think for a lot of fans, they felt more of a connection to Brandon, Pacific Northwest guy. And he was like sort of your family member who just never quite gets it together, you know, never quite lives
for
up to
sure
what he's supposed to be. And then Damian comes along and it's like, well, here's the makeup call for it. Like, here's the guy who's getting a chance to do it.
All right. Well, let's move on. I'll go with my number five. But I have some honorable mentions here. The first, because I had a lot
you
of fun.
You had a top five and you've got nine of them. Great. Here we go.
It's Friday morning and I had a lot of fun over the last hour thinking through games. I got to see LeBron's first title in Miami,
nice,
which was really cool, but the actual games were not that memorable, but like the coronation kind of was. The most fun I've ever had at a sporting event was LSU Alabama football like 6 years ago. This is not a football podcast, but I recommend anyone go to an LSU game. Probably the coolest moment I've ever been a part of was FSU Auburn, another college football game where I was covering it at the Rose Bowl. And I didn't realize this, but like college football media, they let you on the field for the final 5 minutes. And if people remember that game, like the final 5 minutes were insane, and I was standing there on the 20-yard line of the Rose Bowl, which is probably like the most gorgeous stadium in America. And so that's up there for me as well, if we're including non-basketball memories. My first basketball memory was a Georgetown-Syracuse game in like 1995 with Allen Iverson. And I remember...
So he probably had the Jordan 11s.
Yeah,
he probably had those great dark blue Georgetown jerseys with the gray kind of accents.
Yeah, it was a movement. And I remember being like 9 or 10 years old and thinking he was really cool. And I also remember my dad and my dad's friend just like throwing out dad takes, being like, this guy, he's a point guard who thinks he's a two guard.
It's never going to work on the next level.
That's like one of my first memories is walking out of US Air Arena and them bitching about Iverson's
game.
Your
friend's dad's just like, look at his true shooting percentage. This is unbelievable.
Yeah. And the Wizards' funeral game from last year was a lot of fun. And also, my biggest regret is, and I don't know if I've told you about this, I had a chance to cover Mavericks Heat in 2011 for SB Nation, and I said no because I was like, I was super out on LeBron at that point, and I was like, look, they're just going to go win that series in five games, and I don't want to go down there and waste my time. And that is like a...
You opened the door for Greg Doyle to have it all to himself.
Yeah, that was a really tough one. I will probably never live that down. But anyways, I'm going to move to number five on my list is a 24-hour span last February.
Okay.
And it was... No, two Februaries ago, sorry. OKC Golden State, that regular season game where Steph went nuts. Basically, that was the first time we realized that OKC was a really tough matchup for Golden State, and they had no business winning that game. Draymond flipped out in the locker room at halftime.
I'm not a robot.
Yeah, and I think it was Lisa Salters who came out and was like, police had to be, like, stationed outside the locker room. Nobody was sure what was happening.
And that was back in the good old days when that qualified as media drama.
Like, yeah.
Now,
<That's>
a lot has happened in the last 18 months between sort of like positions of power and media entities that kind of overshadow that, but okay.
Yeah, and so I know we're supposed to do things that we were at live, but I vivid...
You're just breaking the rules right off the bat. You had six honorable mentions, your first one was just a game you watched on TV.
I'm going to include the live experience, but that team, that Warriors team, I really connected with because it was like that. The Grantland had ended that fall, and I had basically taken like a couple months off and was following the NBA only through watching Warriors games every night. So I love that Warriors team. Steph was going nuts. And then to pull off that comeback, it was just like, oh my God, like this guy is like not mortal. And I was just in my living room losing my mind. Fast forward 12 hours. The Wizards and the Cavs had a game the next day at like 1 p.m., show up to the stadium, like media members are just like at a loss for words, basically describing what happened the night before with the Warriors and the Thunder, and like guys like David Aldridge, like Michael Lee, like everybody's basically sitting there being like, "What is happening to the league? Like, can anyone ever beat these guys? We've never seen anything like this."
You're like right the epicenter of the earthquake,
and all of this is happening next to the Cavs, who would go on to win the title, but were so fucking miserable that day. And like, this was like peak LeBron's resentment of Steph.
Yeah.
Because just the mood around the team was just awful.
New flavor of the month, LeBron.
Yeah.
LeBron's not liking it.
LeBron was not playing. He actually walked out, and then it was left to Kyrie and Love to play that day. And they got blown out by like 20 against the Wizards team that was not a playoff team at that point. And LeBron walked out of the stadium in the third quarter. And like afterwards, J.R. Smith was talking in like solemn tones, being like, we got to figure this out. Like, so I'll just always remember that sequence and how just miserable they were, and then how crazy it is that it all flipped 3 months later.
I was going to say, that is the ultimate reminder that you can't write a team off, right? Or you can't just pencil a team in to win a title.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that is quite a turnaround. I suspect that we're going to have more moments from that season later on my list. I want to stay on the LeBron angst theme for my number four, though.
Okay.
This is actually one I mentioned before, so I'm not going to go into too much detail with this. You could probably guess that I'm talking about the LeBron David Blatt post-game press conference where
Perfect.
he he overrules David Blatt and makes a huge point of letting all the media in the entire world realize what he had done by saying that he had chucked Blatt's play design. It wasn't just for that press conference, so I was thinking back on why I liked that moment so much. Obviously, the game was pretty good too, but it was the stakes of the game, because remember, that year, 2015, a whole bunch of his teammates are injured. Guys are dropping like flies. Coming into that series against Chicago, people had said, like, there was Cavs beat writers who were picking the Bulls to win that series.
Yeah.
Which, picking against LeBron in the Eastern Conference, like, that had not been a thing.
Well, Kyrie was kind of a shell of himself at that point,
yeah.
too, though.
Yeah, Love was out. Mm-hmm. And, like, Love had just gone down.
Yeah.
And Kyrie was, like, in and out, and it was, like, kind of weird. And the Bulls had Rose, they had Butler, and so, like, they were a squad. And that was my first time ever really covering games at the United Center, right? So I had like this Michael Jordan stan gets dropped into the like the Michael Jordan shrine moment where like, you know, I'm making my pilgrimage to the statue. I'm walking around and seeing all of this, like in the media room, they have newspaper clippings from like every single year from the 90s when Jordan won the title. I'm just like taking literally a picture of every single newspaper clipping, you know, across the entire media room as people are trying to write. And game three happens and Rose hits this insane game winner. And it's like the exact type of shot that the analytics say shouldn't go in. And he's the exact guy who's not supposed to hit that shot. And now it's like, oh, like Chicago, are they really going to do this? Are they going to upset Cleveland? Like, is this going to be the time LeBron
falls apart? They hoisted him on their shoulders.
And
remember,
and then his face is all blank.
Yeah.
And like, it was just goes like a crazy meme because Rose isn't smiling, right? And going into that series, I was like, I knew it was going to be a good series. I was like, wait a minute. This one's getting away from us pretty quick. So then you have all this weirdness down the stretch of game four, like the Blatt thing. Remember when he tried to call timeout? Ty Lue had to basically tackle him. Remember Ty Lue tackled him? He actually had like, I don't know, it was a syringe of some sort of a substance that'll knock you out, but it won't necessarily kill you. So he like puts the syringe in Blatt's neck so that he won't wake up for the rest of the game. So there was lots of weird stuff happening in that game. And of course, controversy around it because everyone in the building is like seeing Blatt try to call timeout and not get it. You know, the refs, the fix is in for LeBron, all this stuff. So we get to that last shot. We should give LeBron credit for hitting that shot. I mean, that was a pretty nice shot. It was not the toughest shot in the world, but it was very dramatic. He's never been good at celebrating. Like, we could just, you know, aside from the tears after winning the title, like, he's never been a natural celebrator, you know?
Look, the shot was one thing. The press conference afterwards was the real performance. I think you talked about it, like, a month or two ago.
Well, that's what I was going to say is because he's not great in the spontaneous moments. Like, sometimes he does the push-down celebration when he hits shots on the row, which he just never really made that work for me. I can't remember a celebration of LeBron's on the court that I liked. But once you give him 15 minutes in the shower to compose his thoughts and write his script for the post-game press conference, there's nobody better. And just the way that Blatt came up, he talked first. No mention of it. He didn't try to get out in front of it. He didn't, you know, he was just basically taking credit for it. Like, hey, we won, da 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 da, you know, and obviously saying, you know, LeBron did it for us, blah, blah, blah. Totally trying to play it off like it's not going to be a thing. And there was never a chance that LeBron was going to let it not be a thing. That press conference was just stunning. I was slack-jawed watching him do that. I had never seen a player.
What, Blatt or LeBron?
LeBron. Yeah. I've never seen a player of that stature go at his own coach like that.
And come out and say they... And who was he trying to draw the play up for?
It wasn't clear who was going to take the shot necessarily. Just LeBron was going to be he was going to be the inbounder, so he wanted to have him have that quick pass. And so presumably it'd probably be J.R. Smith or Kevin Love, right? Or I guess Love was out, so it was probably Smith. But
did you go to the media session the next day when Blatt compared himself to a fighter pilot?
No, I wasn't there for that. I think I was still in a catatonic state in the locker or in the press room trying to type up my column. But what I also remember about that, though, is that it was such a shocking performance from LeBron that I didn't feel like people got it immediately. Because, like, nowadays, and maybe this is just the changing nature of Twitter, too, like, people would type in real time, like what he's saying, right?
Yeah.
This was only a couple of years ago. I remember I tweeted out his full block quote about Blatt, and it went absolutely bonkers. But it didn't seem like people who were either not enough people were watching the stream live, or maybe the people who were like me were all just so stunned at what he had said that we didn't realize like the full magnitude of how he had said it and exactly what he had said.
Yeah.
Because it was like a half an hour delay to where it went from like not a big deal to absolute wildfire. Instead of being like a huge deal the minute he came out of his mouth. So I just remember that being one of those weird situations where like as it was happening, I felt it being huge news. And then it was just like everybody else, you know, like it all came around, like, you know, pretty quickly after that.
It was good passive aggressive LeBron.
Oh,
because
it was peak.
He knew exactly what he was doing, exactly what the implications were.
You know how the Lakers, they retired 8-24 for Kobe?
Yeah.
I think the Cavaliers should retire 23 and then whatever clothing he was wearing from that press conference.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to go way back for my number four.
Nice.
I already talked about Georgetown, Syracuse in 96. This was probably the second big basketball memory I had. It was Bullets Bulls at US Air Arena in Landover, Maryland.
Who are the Bullets?
They were Calvert Chaney, Rod Strickland, a dynasty that we can all remember.
Oh.
And yeah, so this was probably one of my first professional basketball games, and I actually looked up because I remember Jordan like ripping their heart out, and Bill Clinton was there, which was also like a big deal. And I looked up a recap, so I'm just going to read you parts of the recap from Dateline Landover. For three quarters, Chicago Bulls guard Michael Jordan tried his best to shake the effects of a poor shooting night. "I totally couldn't find my rhythm at all," Jordan said. "I played like I was shooting off the wrong leg all night, and suddenly in the fourth quarter, I was able to do it." And even President Clinton, watching from near courtside, had to appreciate the show Jordan put on in the fourth quarter when he scored 18 of his 36 points to carry the Bulls to a 103-99 victory over the Washington Bullets before a sellout crowd.
So reading between the lines, Michael Jordan and Bill Clinton got drunk and golfed
the previous night.
And the hangover wore off for the fourth
lead
quarter.
Really screams hangover in retrospect. And so, but the best part is the Bulls watched their 11-point lead entering the fourth quarter shrink to an 86-85 advantage with 6 minutes left. Jordan then drove the baseline and responded with a dunk and was fouled by Georgie Murison. He hit the free throw, and Chicago's lead was 89-85. Then Jordan hit a three-pointer. Then he faked out Rod Strickland and hit a short jumper. All told, from the time the Bullets got within a point, Jordan scored the next 15 points, and when he was done, the Bulls' lead was 101-94 with 2 minutes left. Like, we forget how routine that was for Jordan.
No doubt.
It's basically just like turn it on, end the game, and nobody can do shit to stop him. And I don't know, man. It was really cool to watch that happen. Another thing from the recap that I really liked was this random throw-in anecdote about Dennis Rodman at the end. He was returning from suspension at this point, and then it says, "Rodman did not complete the game without incident, however. In the second quarter, Murison nailed Rodman with a solid pick. That freed up Juwan Howard for an easy score, and as the players ran up the court, Rodman shoved Murison. Referee Hugh Hollins called a double technical and sending the Bullets bench into an uproar. You get these European players, and they just play dumb," Rodman said. "I knew what he did. He knew what he did. Just don't do it to me. I'm coming at you. I don't care if you're 7'9". That made me miss Rodman. I think Draymond's worthy heir.
Well, now he's like the single biggest key to not having a nuclear war.
Saving the world. Yeah,
he's the guy who's picking fights with giants 20 years ago. It's fantastic.
Also, little known fun fact about this game from the notes at the end. Clinton, who sat 10 rows up at midcourt with Bullets owner Abe Pollin, became the first president to attend an NBA game since Jimmy Carter in 1979. That's a long time. That's like a 20-year span.
Well, it was, I mean, you see the political affiliation.
Reagan
Republicans
wasn't
don't do the NBA, man. I think that's pretty clear.
Yeah, Reagan wasn't trying to watch Bernard King.
It'd be great if Trump's there for the John Wall and Otto Porter and Brad Beal show this year. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, maybe.
Don't think so.
That's really scary to think about. Anyways, yes, it took like an hour to get out because the president was there. But I remember my parents being like, "Well, this is an event. It's Michael Jordan and Bill Clinton. It's worth it." Yeah. So, yeah.
Two enduring 90s icons.
Yeah, totally.
Well, this is interesting because we're in lockstep again here. Uh-huh. I don't know if this is a good thing or if our minds are melding and what this means, but my next game is from the 1996 Bulls, 95-96, November 27th, 1995, early in the season. Chicago makes its only trip to Portland. Now, this team went on to be the gold standard of teams until the Warriors came along in terms of wins. And I just want to just read off their roster for you real quick. Jordan and Pippen started, Longley, Ron Harper. They got Dickie Simpkins in the starting lineup. Off the bench, Steve Kerr, Tony Kukoc, Jason Caffey, Bill Weddington, James Edwards, Randy Brown, Judd Bushler. On this particular night, Steve Kerr scored 10. Scottie Pippen had 21. Nobody else was in double figures, right?
Yeah.
So like you're saying with your Jordan game, you know, Jordan just routinely did these things by himself, right? Portland didn't have the world's greatest roster either, but respectable. Rod Strickland, Cliff Robinson, Aaron McKee, Gary Trent, Chris Dudley, and then the person who's going to factor most memorably into this story is Arvydas Sabonis, was coming off the bench as the 46-year-old rookie who nobody had any idea that he was going to take the league by storm. He had 23 on the night, shooting 10 for 13, hit both of his three-pointers, dishing six assists. I mean, and it just one of those games that made you think, what would this guy have been if he had come over 10 years earlier? Other guys, Buck Williams, James Hollywood Robinson, D'Antonio Wingfield, Randolph Childress. I mean, this is a pretty strong squad.
Great.
in terms of...
Love a good D'Antonio Wingfield mention.
So... this was my birthday present. Okay. The game was a couple weeks after my birthday.
I think this was my birthday present. Yeah. My birthday is February 22nd.
This is what I'm saying.
And Bullets was February 21st.
See, the parallels are a little too close. It's got me a little worried.
It's good. This is bringing us close together after the top 100 pod.
So it's about 2 weeks after my birthday, but I remember the lengths and the efforts that my dad went to get to these tickets. Now, my dad is like one of these guys who's almost too smart for his own good, so he struggles to remember birthdays. He usually lets my mom handle all the little things in terms of schedules and appointments and all those kinds of things, right?
Yeah.
But they had some sort of a ticket gizmo here where you had to buy three preseason games and then two other crappy games just to get the Bulls game if you weren't a season tickets holder, right? So he went through every single loop to make sure we got this, and we didn't really know what we were in for. For the preseason games, we got there. There's 6,000 people there to watch the preseason game, the first one of the year. And we're there all right, let's do this. We're an hour early. So we went through all the motions and everything. So that built the expectations up to this moment, right? And my good friend Holly McKenzie actually found a service that has every single game Jordan played, you can get burned onto a DVD. If you pay, you can buy any game.
Yeah.
So you could go find that Wizards Bulls game if you want it, or Bulls game.
Yeah.
And you can get it on DVD and watch the whole thing. So she did this for me a couple years ago. So I've actually rewatched it. It's incredibly rewatchable. The local commercials are amazing.
Yeah, I bet stuff like that would be the best part.
The commentary is amazing. There's only two refs on the court, you know? So it's and Phil Jackson on the sideline just being the Zen master and But everybody, the whole point of this, it really was just a Jordan showcase. The entire thing was constructed around how is Jordan going to win this game, right? And I'm there, total Jordan stan. The crowd doesn't really have the heart to get down on him.
Right.
Because he's Jordan and it's 96 and he's got the 11s and, they're about to win 72. And they're coming off the title and everything. So last minute of the game, Arvydas Sabonis, who I just mentioned, great player. New sensation, new to the NBA, turns his back. Mike picks him from behind, reaches up to that 7.5 foot, wherever he's got the ball up over his head, swipes him clean, just like he did Karl Malone in the finals a couple years later. Mike takes the ball, gets into that Black Panther mode in the open court, four or five dribbles. Everybody's chasing him. You have no chance.
Yeah.
Dunks it hard at the other end. And you can hear it on the DVD, even though the quality, you can barely even see the quality is not good, but you can hear it on the DVD, the whole crowd just silent. Arvydas Sabonis looking around what just happened? Somebody just mugged me.
That's amazing.
And the Bulls bench, not even as excited as you would expect for this big road win.
Yeah.
Because this is in the closing seconds of the game, it basically seals the game. Because they'd seen it 100 times before.
What did he finish with?
So Jordan's line... As I mentioned, Pippen had 21. Jordan's line, 33 8 assists, only 3 rebounds, 4 steals, and he shot 13 of 22, played 41 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah, just another night, you know?
That's amazing.
And so, yeah, what I love about that, though, is it's just so indelible the way that he did it on both ends. The defense going to the offense. Like, when I saw him steal the ball from Karl Malone a couple years later in the finals,
that's the
come
thing.
Down, hit the jumper, both ends.
When he wanted to, he was just the best defender in the league, too.
Well, smartest
him
player.
Him and Pippen.
Smartest player in the instincts, too, of just knowing what guys were going to do. How did he know where Sabonis was going to put the ball? Sabonis hadn't even really been in the NBA, but he knew exactly where he was going to go. How did he know Karl Malone's blind spot? He'd been studying it for years. Basketball IQ off the charts, and of course, just the signature slam to finish it. So I left there. Really, it was one of those moments where you feel like you're the center of the world. Like, Jordan had that power on fans. Like, make them feel like you have seen this. This greatest moment of your life that you've just experienced, like, he has given this to you. And, like, you know, you feel like you're on top of the world. So that has lasted with me forever. And usually, like, if I was doing this emotionally and not sort of, like, work-wise, this would be my
favorite. That would be number one.
My favorite game ever.
Side note, since we both shared our Jordan anecdotes, people should go read the Jordan Rules. I read it in July. That was my honeymoon reading. And it was, I mean, just the level of insanity that surrounded that team is crazy to read about in retrospect, in part because there's some uncanny resemblances to what's going on with LeBron now. There's just a lot of parallels. And then also, it's funny to read about some of that stuff in hindsight. Like, Phil Jackson was woke about 25 years before it was cool to be woke.
And people didn't know what to do with it.
Same deal with Craig Hodges. Yeah. And Michael Jordan, not as woke, but still incredible to read about his exploits on a night-to-night basis. Yes, my third entry here is the Paul Pierce I called game winner against the Hawks.
Nice.
For a couple different reasons. First of all, I watched this game in person with a Hawks super fan, Rembert Brown, my colleague at Grantland, and we had been talking shit back and forth about the Hawks. I hated that Hawks team. That was the Hawks team that won Player of the Month as the starting five. I just thought it was the lamest shit in the world, basically. And
fluky 60 wins.
It was a classic basketball internet thing where we all started to marvel at one point. SportsCenter, since the Hawks didn't produce any real enjoyable highlights, SportsCenter would do like a Hawks pass counter in the Hawks highlight packages, and I was just like, get this team out of my face. If I wanted to watch college basketball, I would. And having said that, the Wizards had lost. The Wizards would have beaten them had John Wall been healthy. But John Wall went down in game one with the broken hand that the Wizards then misdiagnosed. And there was a whole controversy. And it was just like things were not headed in the right direction. And so I went to that game being like, okay, here we go. I'm going to just watch the end of the season. I have to listen to Rembert talk shit the entire time. And then the Wizards just pulled it off, man. And they also, it was setting up to be like the most Wizards loss of all because they were up 20, I think, like midway through the third quarter, and then were giving the game away to Atlanta before Paul Pierce bailed them out at the end. And it was just pure ecstasy. And half of the enjoyment was watching how miserable Rembert got and just talking trash throughout the night. And then, of course, the Wizards ended up losing the series anyways. After John Wall came back.
Okay, so let me ask you this. So at the beginning of the season, how in were you on the notion that, like, Paul Pierce was going to be that late game saver? Because you know that always gets
pitched.
I was in. Like, when you made that kind of a move, that's like a discussion for a solid week, right, during the summer of, like, Paul Pierce does this, this, and this for the Wizards. Like, they've never really had this.
Yes.
Like, and some, you know, there's a lot of people who are going to take that side. There's also going to be a lot of people who argue passionately against it and be like, you're overstating the effect, et cetera.
I was very much in, and in hindsight, basically watching Pierce's effect on Wall and Beal has sold me on the value of veterans. And they have to be real veterans. They can't just be like warm bodies collecting paychecks. But if the if a, there's a good player who can tutor your young stars, it makes a huge difference. Like that 1 year with Pierce changed Wall's career and changed Beal's career.
And now Melo's going to do it again for you guys.
I hope so. I hope so. Let's get on the phone.
Well, I think another thing about that, too, is like Pierce wasn't that old yet, right? Like, I think that there's kind of this sweet spot between, like, okay, you're not your prime anymore, but you're not 36 like Clippers Paul Pierce, well, where, like, now you're just this veteran who gets Draymond's, like, antagonism.
The thing with Pierce that makes it tough is it's... he's looked old since he was like 25 years old. Like, he kind of like walks with a limp. He's a little like slow footed and has found a way to make it work. So it was hard to tell when looking old became actually old. But yes, I think the Clippers is a good line of demarcation.
Yeah, he was just right in that sweet spot for the Wizards where, like, he's only, like, semi-washed.
Yeah, you know? He was semi-washed. He was washed for the first 6 months of the season.
Yeah, well, and that's sort of, it's really hard to kind of categorize when guys hit that point. And if you can snag veterans at that point of their career, you know, that can really take a team over the top. All right, am I on for number two?
Yes.
So this is where I do suffer from a little bit of recency bias because my last two are from last year, not 2017, but 2016.
Yep.
I'm going with Warriors, Thunder, Oklahoma City, Game 6.
You know what, man? I have been mad about it. I've been mad about this for like the last 18 months. The fact that you got to go to that game will never fail to make me jealous.
It was a pretty insane game. You know I have a soft spot for Oklahoma City in my heart.
Yeah.
You know, Boot Barn, Banjo Museum. I mean, all the...
the Ghost Hotel.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. All these places that just... you get nowhere else really in the NBA. And I have a soft spot in my heart for Thunder fans, too. Because I've kind of seen them grow up. Like, I'm fairly close with Royce Young. Used to work with him at CBS. Like, that's sort of... their franchise has started from infancy. And you kind of see it happen. And to a certain degree, I think, like, in that early Thunder team... that had Harden, went to the finals. I was kind of living vicariously through their fans a little bit because that's sort of what the Blazers were supposed to be, you know? So I was kind of seeing how things could have turned out if their big three had actually stayed healthy and worked together. But in this game, I will always remember it. This is most memorable, maybe not rather than favorite.
Where were you sitting?
They've got you at the back of the 100 level.
Okay.
In a pretty good seat. Good view, but the reason why it's so memorable for me though is because the fans halfway through the fourth quarter, as Clay was just raining in bomb after bomb after bomb after bomb, and it was clear like this was like KD just wasn't stepping up.
Yeah,
like Andre Iguodala was just continually getting steals, and like Westbrook was just like 50% too energetic, you know, like just a little too out of control. They literally couldn't bring themselves to watch it. I've never seen rows of fans turn away from the court, cover their faces during gameplay.
Yeah.
These are diehard fans who stand up at the beginning of every game until they make their first shot, you know? Like, they have all these traditions that they go through. It's a young fan base, but they're all in. I mean, they wear their matching T-shirts with pride. They don't have to do that Jumbotron shaming in Oklahoma City, you know, in a lot of arenas where they're like, hey, put your shirt on, and, like, we're going to, like, kind of shame you into putting your shirt on. They don't have to do that.
Yeah, they're like college fans.
They wear it with pride. And as it was melting away at the end, these people are turning away, covering their eyes. And then as I'm typing up like my tweets at the end of the game to be like, oh, this is an amazing comeback, like Golden State Warriors, season's still alive, da-da-da-da-da, on Twitter, a guy comes over and he's like, you know, he's like, just right, blame it on Kevin. It's Kevin's fault. And it stunned me.
It wasn't Kevin's fault, but it wasn't not his fault.
I understand, but here's what stunned me though, is that the Thunder fans, these guys who were all in, in this moment, probably feeling like the series was going to get away from them because they had to go back to Golden State for Game 7, and you know all momentum had swung.
That it was over at that
with Durant like on the cover of Sports Illustrated, not very long before that, sort of weighing his options in terms of is he going to be back, is he going to not be back, and for that to be the sentiment. He didn't speak for the whole fan base.
KD didn't leave because of that.
No,
because
I'm not saying
of the fans.
He left
because of Russ over dribbling in the fourth quarter for like the fifth straight year, okay, playing them out of the playoffs.
You're saying that. I'm not saying that. But what struck me was that that was even a thought. Like,
yeah.
To me, it was just sort of like, KD, like, he's the one that you're going to, like, you're not even here if not for KD.
Well, if I were a Thunder fan in that spot, I'd be like, I just watched an act of God with Clay. Like, I don't know what to say.
Yeah,
I mean, dude just went off.
It's a great point. How are you going to keep up in a shooting contest with that? Yeah, and afterwards, the other thing, too, was it was just a great example of guys in the post-game press conferences are so good now about putting on their shows.
Yeah.
You know, like, they got the clothes, they got the lines prepared, they've got sometimes, like, jokey things back and forth. But if you look at Russ, you know, and how he was compared to earlier in that series, his body language,
yeah,
his face, everything, those guys wore that loss completely on their sleeves and on their faces. And it was almost as intense. I mean, for not being a finals, for not being like a seasoned.
It was absolutely finals quality.
Yeah, no, but I'm saying, like, not actually, like, this wasn't the end of the season.
Yeah. No.
I can't imagine, or I can't really remember or recall a game that pulled that deep of emotions out of its sort of like key players.
Well, my side of that story, we were podcasting at that point.
Yes.
And I was, again, that year, I was all in on the Warriors. All in on Steph. And I remember talking to you halfway through, because you talk about rehearsed lines in press conferences. Remember when Russ was snickering about Steph's defense?
Oh, yeah.
And then I think the Warriors came back and won a game, and I was like, we might be looking back at that Russ clip like a couple years from now. And so I was all in, loving every second of that game. The other thing that I will say is, I watched that game in a friend's basement in Seattle. I was out in Seattle for my bachelor party. And the, like, you talk about Thunder fans not being able to watch and just watching in dead silence. Watching that game with Seattle fans was amazing, because they were loving every second of it and rooting for KD to leave, for OKC to lose their team.
So it was the Spite Super Bowl?
It was amazing. We had so much fun watching that game. And that's one of my favorite basketball memories of the last 10 years. My number two, we won't go too far into it, but like I've mentioned before, I grew up a hardcore Carolina fan and was probably a hardcore UNC fan before I really like became like obsessive about the NBA. And I in high school was like a recruiting nerd and was like very into this particular North Carolina team. I'm not as into Carolina basketball as I used to be, but when they had Raymond Felton, Rashad McCants, and Sean May, Marvin Williams, Jawad Williams, Melvin Scott.
Well, you've turned on Marvin Williams since.
I know. I feel bad about it. The top 100 tore me away from my Marvin Williams fandom. But I was a senior in college, or senior in high school, and I shared a car with my sister, my younger sister, and before it was the Final Four. And that Saturday, the Heels were playing. I think they played Michigan State in the semifinals. And if they won, I said that I was going to go drive down to Chapel Hill and watch the championship game in the Dean Dome. And my parents were like, if you do that, you're grounded for the rest of your senior year. Like, you're not going down to Chapel Hill by yourself. And
what, were you not like capable of taking care of yourself?
Well, I don't know. I was like 18, and they were just like, no, we don't trust you on a college campus and taking the car. I was going to have to skip a couple days of school.
So they were picturing like drunk driving arrest?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And they weren't wrong to be wary of like what was going to happen. But fast forward to Monday morning, I went to school for one period and grabbed one of my friends and then drove 4 hours down to Chapel Hill, and
nice, risked it all.
Like, had no money at this point. Like, we had to pay for gas and quarters, and we had basically like $40 for the day. And had the best night of my life watching Carolina win the title in the Dean Dome with a bunch of Heels fans, and then like we would tell people like the backstory, and they would be like, "This is amazing! You got to come into our frat." And so we were up until like 6 a.m. jumping through bonfires and everything, and that's tough for me to ever top.
That is pretty ridiculous. So did you get grounded for the rest of your
senior year? I did. I got grounded. She didn't follow through with the rest of the year, but it was a solid like month to 6 weeks.
Well, so let's play act. Like, you come home the next day. Andrew, where have you been?
So I was riding so high after the title win and the night. And I was just like, I have no regrets. You can't touch me right now. So I will go up to my room. Don't even bother lecturing me. It was all worth it.
You're like, take my Xbox.
Yeah,
do whatever
fine.
You want.
It's
I'm good.
Fine. I was riding high.
That's hilarious. All right. Am I up for number one?
Yeah.
My last one, again, kind of cliche, from 2016. It's game 7 of the NBA Finals. The block, the shot, the stop, and the shock. You know, I really think in that arena, I don't want to call the Golden State Warriors fans spoiled before that game, but there always seemed like, especially because of that game 6 like we had talked about, there always seemed like that there was this feeling that somehow the Warriors were just going to figure it out. And as that series started slipping away, the concern level definitely ramped up. But I don't know, in the back of my mind, I was like, they'll finally come and figure some way to just pull this off. I mean, they're the Warriors. They had been untouchable. Steph had been Steph. They'd always had an answer. And halfway through that series, when Draymond gets suspended, it's not, oh, this is going to flip the series. It was, oh, this is going to drag on this one-sided series. Like, oh, the NBA just wants the ratings. You know, like, even the way we were framing those kinds of things.
Completely.
But by the time we got to game 7,
I was all in on the Cavs winning by that point.
Well, and especially once the game started, because that level of confidence or that spoiledness or whatever you want to call it,
yeah,
you know, all of a sudden hearts are in their throats a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, it's funny because I remember this game very well, but it's still almost all of it's a blur. But it was, again, I want to go back to my ability to see the future, because I saw the block like 4 seconds before it happened. Is for whatever reason, I happened to be trained. My eyes were trained on LeBron basically at half court. And, you know, it's easy to look back at the highlights after the fact and just kind of track
great
him.
Great insight predicting a LeBron chase down block after watching 10 years of his career.
Yes.
You really are clairvoyant.
Well, guys, also check out Kyrie Irving. He's a sleeper. He's a sleeper fantasy pick this year. What I'm saying is, though, that on most plays in that situation, my eyes wouldn't have been on LeBron. Maybe it's a coincidence. Yeah. I don't know. But as I saw him there with the straight path, I was like, this is going to end in his favor one way or the other. And I do think that feels fairly clairvoyant if you look back. I didn't have the world's greatest seat to this game, by the way. I was in kind of the end zone, fairly high up. I was sitting next to Lee Jenkins, which is the best seat in the building.
Totally.
Especially
good
during
off the record Lee Jenkins stories.
Especially during LeBron James's best games. That's always a good time. But to see that block unfold, to watch how 20,000 people reacted to that block, in real time, and then for them to finish it off, you know, to take care of it. And then let's not forget, LeBron came about 86% of the way to killing Draymond on that dunk that he missed. I mean, Draymond, that was very, like, at the very end, that was very close to being homicide by dunk.
Yeah.
And so that was just like another thing thrown in the middle of it. The celebration
down
on the court. Oh, my
God, the dunk, man. that's a good point.
People
Sorry.
Forget about the dunk.
Yeah, that would have really, like, split the earth in half.
No, it would have been over. Like, there would be statues of that dunk already. I mean, honestly, if he had finished that dunk, I think you have to put up a statue immediately in Cleveland of that dunk.
Yeah.
And so there was just so many different things going on, but the celebration was great. LeBron really showing true emotion, I thought, for the first time, compared to the Miami days. All the stories that we've kind of beat into the ground, but at that point, they hadn't been beaten in the ground yet because we were still wrapping our minds around it. It's like, wait a minute, the Cavaliers are going to win a title. They're going to overcome a 3-1 deficit. They're going to beat a 73-win team. None of these things, like, to that rational, analytic mind, seemed possible or likely, even with a few minutes left in that game, and they did it.
It's been about 6 months since I've taken credit for predicting that particular Cavs title.
Yeah.
But if you recall,
you're back around. Yeah, during the playoffs, I remember like, you got one right.
I wrote it in the magazine. Yeah. I was like, look, LeBron is one of the three best players of all time, and he needs something unfathomable to cement his place there.
Yes.
And so that's why, like, halfway through the series, I mean, the Cavs had zero business winning that title. Yeah. And they...
Let me ask you this. Do you
feel like the Draymond suspension should be more of an asterisk than it is?
I was going to say, do you think it's a fluky title now that we've had a little separation?
A little bit, but I also think that the Warriors are going to end up winning, like, four titles. And we're going to look back and see that one LeBron title, and it'll be a testament to his greatness, which is probably appropriate because he is that great. And yeah. So, like, future generations should look back and be like, the Warriors were amazing, but so was LeBron.
You know what I think about when I look at that? It's like if they do win 4 out of 5 here, like they've already won 2 out of 3, they could easily get to be 4 out of 5. I feel bad that people like Steve Kerr are going to look back at the one they lost. And that one's going to like nag them more than all the wins combined.
Yeah.
And it maybe it should.
I don't know. I don't really know. Can I critique your list, though?
Sure.
The Klay Thompson game should be number one.
No.
That...
No.
That was like a religious experience.
It's also a Western Conference Finals.
Game 7, as I watched that game, like both teams were so tight. It wasn't actually enjoyable.
The fourth quarter wasn't great, and it had been sort of a one-sided series back and forth. But the tightness actually, I think, being there made it a better experience because it was like all these players are choking simultaneously. This is a real thing.
It felt more like a football game where like guys were just sort of like barreling into the lane and hoping that something fell.
If I had to pick only one game to watch again in person, though, I would definitely pick the finals because to me, the jump from a Western Conference Finals to like, you know, and I love the show. You know, there are many years where I will argue that the Western Conference Finals is the real finals, right?
Yes.
But the finals is different. A game 7 of the finals is different. A game 7 involving LeBron and Steph both in their prime. That's just a different level. I mean, I look at it and I look back at the last 7 or 8 finals that I've covered, and there were some awesome moments, like the Spurs with a crazy ball movement against Miami. Obviously, Ray Allen shot all of them. I'll take a game 7, even with its ugliness, over all of them because of the historical implications, the weight to it. Yeah. And
you're all about the history, man. I know you.
Well, and the tight finishes.
I will be jealous forever that you got to see the Warriors game 6 in OKC.
No, you like the bucket getters.
I'm not jealous of game 7.
That's because you like the bucket getters.
My number one, and we've already gone too long, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it because you can go back and listen to me, my brain melt after John Wall's game winner.
Oh, I wasn't Olynyk?
No, there are
two. It was going to be Olynyk's game look, 7.
The Olynyk game 7 is unquestionably the worst sports memory I have. I don't ever want to relive that night. Walking out of the Fleet Center with the Celtics fans chanting Olynyk's name. But yes, my number one sports memories are the most incredible games I've been to. There's a tie at the top. And the first is Gilbert Arenas in, I think it was maybe 2006 or 2007. It was game 6 against the Cavs. I had tickets and I was randomly sitting behind Zydrunas Ilgauskas' family. And
how could you tell it was them?
Just a couple just of 10, giant white people. It was unbelievable. And then probably the most heartbreaking experience I've ever had at a game because Gilbert Arenas hit a 30-foot three to tie it and send it to overtime. And go back and watch a shot. It was incredible. And that had been another thing where like all year there had been back and forth trash talk between LeBron, who was like pretty fake, and Gilbert Arenas, who seemed like he was about to lead like the People's Revolution at that point in time.
He sort of did.
Yeah, he did for a while. And then the end of that game kind of forecasted his downfall because like LeBron came and whispered into his ear. He missed 2 free throws, which opened the door for Damon Jones to hit a game winner. And I was with a girlfriend at the time, and I remember just like it was just a dark, dark night. It's not a positive memory, but it's definitely like the most indelible memory I have from watching games in person until John Wall this past spring, because that was another emotional roller coaster where I was like, man, they are really going to give this game away at home. And then Beal picked it up and carried the offense in the second half. And Wall couldn't really hit a shot until that final one, and just did a bunch of little things and kind of willed his way back into the game. And you can go back 6 months and listen to how over the top I was afterward.
You didn't have a voice, if I remember.
I didn't really that's right. I didn't have a voice. I ended up getting sick because afterwards it was like 60 degrees and raining, and I was just walking around the streets high-fiving people.
With no clothes on.
That was another one. It was like the Lillard situation where like people were hugging, and it was wild. And then they lost the series. So long story short, this is why everyone should be rooting for the Wizards to like turn it around somehow, because all of our best memories end in heartbreak, but I don't give a shit because that John Wall game was so much fun that it was worth it, and the Olynyk experience in Game 7 didn't matter.
So you nitpick my number one. Let me quickly ask you one question.
What?
And it's going to sound a little condescending, but like, does it bother you that it wasn't on that top stage? Or that it didn't pay off? Like,
no, and in large part because I've just never had the experience of rooting for a team that's like regularly on that top stage. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel entitled to that. And it would be weirder to me if like I grew up a Celtics fan with a team that was competing for titles every spring.
So like John Wall hitting a three to win like game four of a finals like 2 years from now, is that like is that an impossible dream?
It would break my brain. I don't know how I would react.
Okay. That's actually very instructive. I'm glad we got that in.
Thank you. But look, this was a lot of fun. This was a good idea. And thank you to everyone who's listening. Please review. Please subscribe. Tell your friends. Send us emails at openfloormail@gmail.com. And we will be back on Friday with a mailbag.
We will. 5-star reviews on iTunes, Instagram, art criticism, Ben Doc Oliver. Everybody check out Andrew's article. He kind of tore apart the top 100, had some interesting surface level takes. And Sharp, I'll see you next week.
All right, man.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.